You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Faye, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. When lightning strikes, where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hi. This is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about the tingly mic drop moments that led you to becoming an artist. Alex Edelman is a comedian and writer whose Orthodox Jewish upbringing has helped inspire his critically and commercially lauded work for the stage and screen. He is known for his TV writing and solo stage shows. In fact, all three of his shows have been hits on London's West End and at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. His current solo show, Just For Us, is playing at the Cherry Lane Theatre in New York City. Congratulations on your extraordinary show, Just For Us. For people who might not know what the show is, or if somebody were to ask you, what is this show about, what would you say?
It's a show about identity and empathy and the limits of our and the limits of those things and the constraints of those things. But more broadly, it's about a Jew who goes to a meeting of white nationalists in Queens. So, yeah, that's exactly, or more specifically, I guess I'd say that's what it's about.
And there's so much of you and your family embedded and you're in the show, and it's heart wrenching at times. It's hilarious. When did you get the inspiration to write about it?
Do you know, honestly, I was writing on a TV show in Los Angeles, and the show was, it was a fun show with great people, but I was just sort of starting to get burnt out. And then when the show ended, I said to my agent, let me take like a break for a couple of weeks and let me just try to find some, let me just go and do a whole bunch of weird stuff. So I did a whole bunch of weird stuff. This is end of 2017, beginning of 2018. And I went to that thing and I did a bunch of other things around that time, 2017, 2018. And then at the beginning of 2018, I was in London. I have a residency there at this place called the Soho Theater, where it was the best. It's the best theater in the world, I think. It's a place where people incubate and run solo comedy shows. And I just kind of, I got on stage. This is end of January 2018. And something just started to sort of take shape, and that was the show. So that was, I guess, beginning of 2018.
Is it okay to give away what prompted the story? Or
sure, go ahead.
Well, maybe you should tell. You saw this tweet from a white nationalist, and
oh yeah.
I keep brave.
I keep track of. I like to look at the worst people on the internet. I'm always constantly searching for the worst, you know, worst political opinions, worst opinions general. And so this was up there. This was one of them. And I sort of went down the rabbit hole and started looking at these guys on various platforms, trying to follow them on various platforms. And obviously almost always keeping very quiet. And I saw this tweet from someone on the list. And the tweet said, hey, if you're curious about your whiteness or something like that, come to this address. And I ended up going to the address, and that's how, sort of the impetus for the show.
I just think of your bravery to go. I don't want to give away too much because the storytelling is just absolutely brilliant, and it's exciting to experience it, you know, as you tell it. But I think of the courage it took to go to an apartment building, a private apartment building.
It's a specific kind of curiosity that will make you go. But I've also gone to a lot of places that aren't in the, I've gone to conferences on nuclear Iran. I've gone to, you know, I've taken flyers from people on the subway trying to get you to go to these radical churches. And I've sat there in those churches, then listen to them say some stuff that wouldn't be exactly considered politically appropriate. Like, I think what's interesting, you know, like, it's important for people to be clear-eyed about what's at the very fringes of good taste and polite society without, you know, without being like, oh, I, you know, without dismissing it out of hand and trying to, by dismissing it out of hand, I'm not saying that we should be like welcoming white nationalists into anything, but I am saying it's important to know what the most egregious citizens are saying to each other on a regular basis. So that's why the show is, you know, that's what's at the center of the show, I guess.
And I love how open-minded you are. I mean, that's a beautiful thing. I was just thinking more of that, of your safety, you know, of going to a private address in an apartment building, you know, thinking
they were like bears, though. They were more afraid of me than I was of them. And this isn't in the show, but at some point someone goes, are you a cop? You have to tell us if you're a cop. And I'm like, no, I'm not a cop. But like, it was, they were terrified that there was someone in their apartment. I actually do. And also there are, the show is art, not journalism. So I don't want to, but the reason I say that is because like some woman was like, one of the people there was like, you're trespassing. You're trespassing right now. And I was like, oh shit, am I trespassing? Like, am I, you know, am I the one who's going to be in trouble here? You know, like, that is, I don't think I, if she wants to press charges now, it seems kind of silly, but, yes. But if she wants to be like, hey, excuse me, I was, you know, I'm a white nationalist and this guy trespassed in my apartment at a meeting of other white nationalists, you know.
Well, they tweeted out the meeting. When did you know that this was the fodder for a show? I know Nora Ephron used to say, everything is copy. But did you leave, or were you in a moment there where you thought, oh, God?
Well, I knew as I was being kicked out that this was a story I was going to tell friends. But it wasn't until I told a couple of friends, I told my friend Morgan, I told my friend Nick, I told my friend Chloe, I told my friend Danny. And I think three of those four people went, you should probably do material about this, you know? And I think it took me a minute. I think it took me a minute to sort of get it all together and make myself, it took me a minute to get it together and make myself aware that this was like, cause telling a story to your friends, like making the, I think a big trick to doing a solo show is making it feel like you're talking to an audience in the way that you would talk to your friends. But honestly, the craftsmanship of talking to your friends is huge. Like, or sorry, the craftsmanship of telling a story for an audience is huge because you want to caveat things, you want to buttress things, you want momentum, you want to make a side seem intentional. Like everything is, you know, everything is what it, sorry, everything needs to be carefully calibrated when you're putting together a solo show. So, or putting together even like a bit of like trenchant stand up. So, this is a longer answer than it needs to be. But I knew it was going to be a story immediately for friends, but it took talking to those friends to realize that was a story for the stage.
What do you mean when you say, I love that everything needs to be calibrated? Can you tell me more about that?
My favorite stand-up belies a particular point of view, but it welcomes people from every point of view to understand that. I need to be empathetic with white nationalists, but not sympathetic with white nationalists.
Yes. Like which that, you do. Yeah.
But that takes a lot of careful, and I need you to see the banality. And also, like, there was one person in that room, and I don't say this explicitly on stage, but I sort of communicate. The guy whose name in the show is Wit, right? Like, there was someone in that room who was very funny to me. Like he had little tics and habits and energies that made me go, oh, I would laugh at this person with this, you know? And so, like, you know, I want to communicate that, but I don't want an audience to be like, oh, look at a cuddly picture of white nationalists. And so the way to do that, the secret to both sides-ing everything is to present it within a personal perspective, right? Like, this show is not a referendum on white nationalism. This show is not a treatise on anti-Semitism. This show is not a insistence that the world is a certain way or that, quote unquote, these people are a certain way. This is just a story based on something that happened to me, told in a fashion that I think is resonant, right? Like, told and emphasize. And by the way, I'm not making choices. I'm choosing to emphasize certain things. I'm choosing to leave out certain things. I've changed some details for my safety and the safety, like, because frankly, I don't want these people ever reentering my life. And I have nightmares about them doing so. Trying to make it accessible. And also, the show is both specifically Jewish. Like, if you are Jewish, you have, I think, an access to this show. But also, if you love Jews or are curious about Judaism, or, and I say, I'm serious. Like, if people have at any point, you know, had sympathy or empathy or enjoyed something Jewish, then I think they access a show in a certain way. And if you don't know Jews at all, you access a show in a certain way. And the show needs to be for people across that spectrum. So that's what I mean by calibrating it. Sorry, Gerald, that's a really long answer.
No, it's a smart answer. And you really fall in love with your family as well. And who they are and the kind of humans they are to embrace others, not of the tribe. I'd love to know, what's your lightning strikes moment? When did you know you had to be an artist, or the moments in your life that set you on this path?
Mel Brooks.
Uh-huh.
You know, my grandmother and my grandfather playing the 2,000-year-old man for me was special. My parents, I've never talked about this actually, but my parents sent me to see a production of Spamalot in Boston.
Where you grew up, right?
I just laughed and laughed and laughed. And also, Alan Zweibel and Billy Crystal have written a solo show called 700 Sundays.
Yes.
And it just, I have never, you know, the cliche people go, I laughed and I cried. There is a moment in 700 Sundays that I can still remember. It's like a bell in my head, where Billy Crystal says something about his father, and it's, and I laughed and I cried at the same time. I was hysterically laughing and sobbing. And Billy Crystal, mostly people know him as, like, you know, a guy who does family comedies now, his skill, so undeniable in that moment, that show. I think I was 16 and I waited for Billy Crystal at the stage door afterwards, which I'm embarrassed to say. And he came out and I had a baseball. They were selling these 700 Sundays baseballs, and I think I lost it, which is so devastating. If anyone knows Billy Crystal, but I want him to get me a signed 700 Sundays Baseball because it was, but it had a really profound impact on me, that show. And even, by the way, the cast of Spamalot in Boston, I waited. My parents took me, and then I went down there a separate night on my own. I think I'm 16 still, or 17. And I waited for them outside the stage door, and I asked if I could see the sets from the back. And these nice performers took me in, and they showed me how they did the nights. Because there's a thing where the night gets disemboweled, basically. And it's beautifully done and really funny. And they showed me how they do it. And it was just a really nice touring cast. So I think those shows were great. And my first Broadway show, I saw a bunch of Broadway shows. My parents would occasionally take me to town. I saw The Wedding Singer with Stephen Lynch, which wasn't very good, but there were great parts of it. I saw shows like All My Sons with Katie Holmes, which was, I thought, very good. And the first thing I saw in New York was In the Heights when I came here for college. So all these things made me love the solo show format or made me love theater, but comedy, there were a bunch of great comics in Boston, and there was a CD by a guy named Brian Regan, whose work I've always loved. And Brian is sort of a friend. What's crazy is that some of these people are friends of mine now, you know, like some of those folks are, you know, the first show that I saw that truly, truly hooked me and made me want to be part of like the community once I was in college. Cause like I saw In the Heights when I got to NYU. Is this too tangenty or is this like, you know,
no, it's great. With Lin-Manuel, was he in it at that point?
He was. It was awesome. It was really great. But that felt like a pipe dream. I saw a show called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson.
Alex Timbers. Yeah.
Alex Timbers. Yeah. Michael Friedman, I think, was the composer. Rest in peace. Ben Walker, who was a stand-up. Mm-hmm. I saw it because this guy Ben was a stand-up. And then they were like, you know, Ben's on Broadway in this show. So I went to go see the show, and it actually cost a fortune to get in.
Yeah.
But Broadway shows were almost always very inaccessible for me because they were so expensive. But Bloody was so good, and I saw Ben, and I went, Ben, can I come to this again? And he's like, yeah, what do you mean? And I was like, you know, I think I might want to see it again. He's like, yeah, Alex, people see Broadway shows like more than once sometimes. And I was like, okay. So I saw the show, I think like three times. I really loved Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. I wrote like a long paper on it for a class in college. And like, you know, the idea of a lightning strike moment is, for me, it's not been, you know, it's like, as Hemingway says about going bankrupt, it's one of those things that happen very gradually and then all at once. Right. There were moments when I got to England and I spent my last semester of NYU at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. And I saw these solo shows at the Soho Theater and fell into this community who supported me as I started to build my own solo shows. Like Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who does Fleabag, was a huge, huge help to me early on. This is before she was I slept on Phoebe's mom's couch for a while when I was putting things together. And Phoebe's a big part of, I met my director, Adam Brace. This is a bit name droppy, but I met my director at Phoebe's birthday party in 2013. And Adam and I have been collaborating since 2014. And he's the director on this show. In fact, I'm literally just reading Adam's play, They Drink It in the Congo. I've had really great luck in terms of my lightning strikes. I've not been let down by any of those people in terms of meeting them. They've all been extremely kind, and even Lynn, who I've only crossed paths with, you know, in passing once or twice, and I always try to be cool. he's been really nice and yeah, it's a great set of community.
What When you got to NYU, did you, I know you said it was so gradual, your path, but did you enter NYU as a, as any kind of performing arts, what, or writing, or what was your major at NYU?
I was an international relations major, politics.
I love that.
I was not international relations and philosophy. There was very little. I also have a sort of antiquated, not antiquated, but I have a bit of a rigid, closed-minded view about theater. About college, which is that I truly believe that people should go to college for educations, not jobs, which is very highfalutin. But I wound up being an English literature major with a creative writing minor. So, but I got a great education at NYU, and I had the best professors. I had folks like Darren Strauss and Jonathan Lethem and Nathan Englander, who have all had their own theatrical moments in the sun. Zadie Smith was one of my professors, Susan Orlean, Megan O'Rourke. I took classes from just the best people. Brian Waterman, who came to see my show the other day, which was so cool. Like I've had really good luck and really great, joyful moments.
I know you said you took your last semester in London and had that mm-hmm. incredible moment, the Soho Theater, but how did you go from being this NYU student, and seeing lots of theater to getting into stand-up? How did that happen?
I was a stand-up first. I was much more of a comedian. Theater was a pipe dream for me. It just was one of those things where it was my taste and so was stand-up, but it took me until my early 20s to try to put the two together. I wanted to always be a stand-up with a little more theatricality. Right. Like I was a little bit left of center with some of my interests, a little bit queer, a little bit a little bit Jewish, a little bit thoughtful. But I loved the hard, cold punchlines of stand-up comedy. And I still do. My show truly is a stand-up comedy show. Like the show has got, it's just all of the bits are very personal. But, before this run, my last warm-up for the run was at a comedy club in Cleveland called Hilarities. The idea for this show is that it can work in any space. I've done it in dentist offices, comedy clubs, the highest brow theaters. I did it in the courtyard of a contemporary art museum in North Adams, Massachusetts at Mass MoCA. Show is – I always love the stand-up comic idea that you can put yourself in a briefcase and just travel and eat that way. And so theater is a wonderful luxury for me. But ultimately the show is me, right? The show is one person. I've always found that really appealing, which is the litheness of a stand-up comedy approach. The necessary minimalism of stand-up comedy really appeals to me. Like my set deck, they said to me, you should have a set for your show. And I said, I don't want it. I'm a stand-up comic. I was like, it should just be me. It should be me and a microphone. But then, I saw the wisdom in and by the way, this probably is one of those things where I need to slowly edge out of my comfort zone in a way and start putting sets together and, make things slightly more ornate. But the show does have set decoration, but you'll probably notice it. Mm-hmm. The set decoration is all, I don't want to ruin it for people to see the show. It's weird that this is a detail I'm circumspect about, but the set decoration is all various implements that are used for stand-up. There's, the stools mm-hmm. and the microphone, and those things are, the show is supposed to work for stand-up comedy in a stand-up comedy aesthetic. I'm very proud of it having elements of stand-up comedy in it.
I'm just curious, when did you first start doing stand-up? Was that in Boston or at NYU that you started doing your stand-up?
I started in Boston.
In high school.
I started got rollerblading to open mics in high school and then
rollerblading?
I was roller. Mic? I know. I know. I would rollerblade. What?
During open mic? Wait, rollerblading during open mics or
no?
To
no, I'd rollerblade to music open mics in. I would rollerblade to music open mics in like Boston suburbs. I didn't realize that comedian. I thought that the only comedians allowed at comedy clubs were huge comedy acts. So I was like, oh God, you know, if I want to start stand-up comedy, I need to start at little open mics and music open mics. So I would go, and I was the only, I was terrible. I was so awful. I was as bad as you could possibly think I was worse. I was like, I didn't really start to like put it together until college.
When you say music, were you playing music? Or
no, I was doing stand-up at music open mics. People hated me. Gerald, this was a bad fit that I was committed to. Like, I was awful. I would torture these audiences with mediocre half-based stand-up for a long time. Like, I was a bad comedian.
So you started writing your material in high school.
In high school.
Yeah, and then you went from there. And what about UCB? How did that come into your life?
Well,
Citizens Brigade.
You know, the funny thing is I never trained there. There was a group called Gentrify, show called Gentrify. And it was run by Mackenzie Condon, Darcy Carden, who's now Janet on The Good Place, Brendan Scott Jones, who's an extremely funny character actor, Justin Tyler, who's just hilarious podcaster, actor, comic, like seven or eight of the Alden Ford. Like, these are the funniest people I had ever met and still are some of the funniest people I'd ever met. And they had a show in New York, and they would throw me on this show. This is like 2014, 2015. And I built my first solo show, Millennial, which is what gave me a career at this little night. Every Friday night at UCB, I'd go to Shoal, and then afterwards I'd walk over to this place in UCB East, in the East Village. Yeah. And it was just the best place to do anything. I was so, so lucky. I'm still so lucky.
UCB
oh my,
East.
You know, I haven't thought about it. The Beast. I miss the Beast.
The Beast. The Rest carpet, the blue carpet. But did you audition? How did you get?
I was doing stand-up. I was always a stand-up, but they let me do. But these guys just, for some reason, I still don't know why. These guys were, and also I was like still trying to figure out how to like be not socially maladroit with people. Like these guys were just really nice. They had endless patience for a young comedian, and I would just show up and they would throw me on almost every week. And like, I'll always be so grateful to them. But no, it was the UCB scene I fell into through stand-up. There were other stand-up shows, Lasers in the Jungle, which Dan Wilbur was one of the hosts of. It was UCB stand-up that really UCB, The Pit, The Tank, those sort of like early 2010s stand-up venues, Luna Lounge, Lit Lounge, those places were where I started getting up and making some money and starting to earn a little bit of a name as a comic. But it was because of those UCB people who were like really nice to me, who saw like a little something here or there.
It's incredible. And how did you get involved though with the Soho Theater? How did that happen? I know you said you were in England, and then how did you know to apply there, or how did that happen?
I didn't apply. You know, my life, and maybe this is a bit of my life has been characterized by just showing up at places I wanted to be and never leaving. And like, that's what happened at the Soho Theater. I saw a bunch of shows there. I really liked it. I kept going. I started sitting in the cafe during the daytimes and writing material. And everyone kind of thought I was like a little nuts. And then my first solo show did really well. And everyone's like, oh man, I guess he's not like super nuts. I guess there's something else going on there. And yeah, I mean, the Soho sort of just accepted me and let me stay. And it was a great situation. And now I'm sort of a house. Now I'm sort of like a bit of, that's a bit of my like hometown. That's sort of like a, I'm sort of a hometown comedian there when I perform at the Soho. So I love it a lot, that place.
It's so incredible. And your family is such a presence in this piece. What is their take on it?
They love it.
Yeah. What is it like when they see it?
You know, my parents haven't had a chance to see it yet. They came to an early workshop in London at Soho. And I think they knew that there was something there. My mom saw it in January of 2020 when I did as a one-off, and she had a really good time and thought it was very good. My mom is really, it's so funny. My mom is a very, very direct. She said to me, you know, I didn't like your second solo show. I've done three. This is my third. She went, the first one was good, and this one's better than the first one. It's really, really good. But the second one, I didn't like as much. And I was like, okay. You know, like my mom is, that's the kind of person my mom is. They're just like happy that I have make a living doing something that I love, which is truly, I've also benefited tremendously from, you know, their patience and willingness to send me to do stuff. And also this sort of like leeway that they gave me as a young kid to sort of rollerblade around Boston in, you know, the 2000s and just be in various, you know, spaces, put myself in.
Well, they come off as, yeah, they come off as real mensches in this, in this piece. And maybe this is too lofty, but how has this experience doing the show changed you writing it? Because you really do a deep dive into who you are and your family and their values.
I think it's made me more, I think it's calmed me down. I think I carried, you know, even all the way through, I guess through 2019, I carried a lot of insecurity with me. Not that I'm not still insecure. Everyone's very insecure. But I think it was characterized by a frenetic energy in my 20s. And in my 20s, I think it was characterized by sort of being like, and I think this is sort of a more mature step. The show is, my director, Adam, said that the show signifies my transition from little brother comedian to big brother comedian, which I think is a really good way of understanding my artistic arc. I know that's a little high. That's a very, very pretentious thing and a little self-aggrandizing. But, you know, if you look at my early work with, you know, heavy air quotes, my early work is characterized by sort of like a puckish, impish energy. And I think that thing will never leave. But I also think that this sort of is a little more authoritative and confident in a way that the early stuff wasn't. There will always be sort of a yin yang, right? Of confident and, I mean, I'll always have, like, I think I early on had the, you know, I think because I'd watched so much comedy and was just sort of emulating the comics that I loved, I sort of carried myself on stage a little more, like, you know, solid than I was, which is good and bad. And now I think I'm sort of grown into a little bit. So I'm not faking that quite as much, but yeah, I've been very lucky. And I think that this show has really resonated with people. I'm so thrilled that this show has resonated with people. It's coming for me at the right time in my life as a comic. So, yeah.
And how did Mike Birbiglia get on board?
I mean, I fucking love Mike Birbiglia. He's my comedy rabbi. him and comics like Gary Gulman and Maria Bamford and, you know, and this guy in Boston named Tony V were the comics that I most admired growing up. But I also, like, Mike I've always been a big fan of Mike. And then when he was doing the new one on Broadway, I got a DM invitation going, hey, if you want to come see Mike's show, he'd be happy to have you. And I was like, yeah, fucking please. And so I went to go see the show. I brought Ben Walker, actually, as my my buddy and guest. And we had a good time and really enjoyed it. And then afterwards, I said a quick hello. And then when he was in LA, I went to the show with my friend Ingrid. And after that show, I went dropped by to say hi. And he went, I hear you have a good solo show. And I was like, yeah, you know, this is 2019. I said, yeah, you know, I'm just trying to make everything work. This is October, November 2019. And he said, well, how can I see the show? And I said, I'll send you a tape. And he said, that doesn't work for me, actually. How about I put it up for one night in New York and we see if it's any good. And maybe we can do something with it. And that was January of 2020. And then after that show, he said, hey, the show is good, but it needs some changes. And he recommended some changes that were very hard. And I knew that they were hard because my director, Adam, had recommended those same changes too. And they were too hard for me. So I had a UK tour coming up, which was truncated by COVID. And I said, okay, how about I use this UK tour to try to implement those changes? And I slowly did, and the show got better. And then in March of 2020, he was like, hey, you know that June or July of 2020 thing that we were talking about? That's not happening now. Oh. And yeah. Yeah. He called me in October of this year or October. Yeah. October of this year. And he went, it's happening December 1st. And I was like, what the fuck? I was like, for real. And he's like, yeah, for real. Start getting it ready. And I was like, I panic booked all of these different shows in like Phoenix and Madison and, you know, Cleveland and Bloomington, you know, like anywhere that would have me for anything, you know, anywhere that would have me. I went and did it and had just a blast. It was the coolest.
And here you are. You did it. Yeah.
It's so great. And also it's a lot of fun because, you know, we've gotten a couple, like it's a show that travels pretty easily. Like Brown Hillel went, we'd like to put the show up. And I'm like, yeah, like it's a show that I can roll out of bed and do without, you know, I do a lot of homework before the show. My production coordinator, MC Mangum, who works on the show with me before every show, we write down a list of six things to remember before the show, and they're always different. So the show is always changing every little bit by degrees. It's like this living organism. So it's this really fascinating exercise where you watch the show. Someone who saw the show in January of 2018, someone who sees it now will be like, oh my God, this is a different show. But obviously that'd be the case for anything 4 years later, but it's a, you know, the same story, but very different. So, yeah.
Are you comfortable sharing what the note was, what they said the sure. change should be? What was it?
I really love the fact that, you know, that my shows can pull in far-flung things like I love the disparate things that are in my show.
Yes.
But sometimes that love can be, can have a drawback, which is that it's not as focused. And so they went, these bits are nice and they get really good laughs, but they're not focused, they're tangents. So how about you kill the tangents and you focus more on the show? And I was like, but I like my tangent. And they're like, yeah, but it doesn't belong in the show. And that's really hard to reckon with. That's really hard to wrap your arms around. And they were right. I hate to admit that they were right, but they were right. And yeah, the show is better for it. The show is, there is a full 10 minutes of, or 15 minutes almost, of material that has come out of the show relative to its UK tour, and people, and this is just, it's just a better show now. It's a shame. I should have done it earlier. Frankly, I'll kick myself for a while for not doing it, but you know, c'est la vie.
Well, maybe you weren't ready. Maybe you had to, you know, get to that place. But it sounds like you just, all these experiences, all these people came into your life, but was there any kind of training, or was it just existing in the world?
I've never taken a class.
Wow.
But also, like, you know, I work with Adam Brace, who's this guy, this director, and he's a really smart, you know, the play that I'm reading of his right now, you know, they did it at the Alameda in 2016 in London. And Seth Barish, who's Mike's director, worked with me for a couple of sessions. Oh. Gary Gulman sat with me in a hotel room in Charlotte and watched the whole show and gave notes. Gosh. Like, so I don't really have and Danny Jollis, who's my, like, I have friends. Moses Storm, who's another young comic, came to see the show, like, and gave notes. Like, I've never taken a class, but I have always, I've been going to school on this since I was 13. So it's a lifelong thing. And also, I'd be really open to it. My friend Zach Zucker is an incredible clown. And, you know, he was like, let me teach you clowning. And I was like, yeah, man, like, you know, anything that will add to the arsenal. So I'm very, I'm not like, look at me, comedy's Goodwill Hunting over here. But like, I've never taken a class, but I've been allowed to sit and watch, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of performances from the best people and get to learn from that. So it's not exactly like I hustled and scrapped and did it all on my own. I just had people who were willing to let me watch and answer any question. Josh Harmon, mm-hmm. who's one of my favorite playwrights.
Oh, he's brilliant. Yeah. Bad Jews.
Yeah. Who I love, came to an early version of this show or not early version. He came early on in this run, but Josh has a...
So brilliant.
Josh, at the beginning of the pandemic, took some time with me to get on Zoom and talk about plays. And that had a big effect on remounting the show. So, and Josh teaches playwriting at Columbia. So it's not like I've not taken any formal classes, but I've had private tutoring from the best.
It's amazing. Well, it's such a pleasure to connect. And thank you so much for sharing, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. And thank you so much for coming to the show. Please, if you're listening to this, please do come see it, because it's my best work so far. So, yeah.
It's just delicious.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you.
It still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know.
The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore. And the talent was booked by Anna Stratt.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.